This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and finally, we have some clarity.
On April 19th, Patriots Day, the general public will become eligible to be vaccinated here in the Commonwealth.
That is Governor Baker earlier today, delivering the news that so many across the state have been waiting for. And essential workers, those age 60 or over, are eligible starting March 22nd. WBUR Senior Statehouse reporter Steve Brown was there today, joins us now. Welcome back, Steve.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So for our hungry listeners, there's a whole series of dates. Lay it out for us. What news did the governor deliver?
Okay, get ready to circle some dates on your calendar. Starting this coming Monday, that's March 22nd, everyone 60 years or older is eligible for the vaccine. Also in that group, qualified essential workers. Think grocery store employees, transit workers, and the like. They're all eligible. That's as of March 22nd. Fast forward 2 weeks, Monday, April 5th, that will be open to people 55 and older, as well as anyone who has one qualified medical condition. And finally, 2 weeks after that, as we just heard the governor say in the opening bite there, April 19th, Patriots Day, everyone in Massachusetts above the age of 16 is eligible to be vaccinated, regardless of age, job, or medical condition.
So I'm not going to lie, this feels like good news, Steve. You have covered these pressers more than a year now throughout this pandemic. Was the vibe different today, hearing this news and with the Baker team presenting it?
Sure, there definitely was a change in tone. Remember the past couple of weeks as folks competed for a limited number of vaccines? The governor was really frustrated with the feds because there was no indication that the state would see increases in its weekly allotment. He seemed more optimistic following a conference call yesterday when the feds indicated vaccine production is ramping up. And because of that, he feels they can now safely put out this schedule of when people will become eligible.
All right, you just made reference to the fact that people were competing for a limited number of vaccines. So we know, already hard to get appointments. Can the state handle the kind of increased demand that's going to come with opening this up to everyone over the age of 16 in Massachusetts?
They seem to think that they can, so long as the number of vaccines keeps increasing. The governor said all along the infrastructure for giving out the shots is there. There are over 200 places around the state where you can go get the vaccine. It was just the lack of an adequate supply to meet the demand that was out there that created the logjam we've had for the past month or so.
Although I do want to note, it's not as if supply has quadrupled from last week to this week. We are still in a limited phase, right?
Sure. They're ramping it up. I think just a quick back of the envelope count that I saw, this looks like about 35,000 more first doses this week over last week. So, that's considerable. 35,000 people. It's more than the number of people that live in my town.
And to that point, Steve, do we know, did you hear anything about how long it could take to get vaccines to everyone who wants one?
They don't know exactly, since they don't know how many people who have been eligible have been putting off getting a shot for one reason or another. They do expect to pass a milestone within the next 24 hours, and that is 1 million people fully vaccinated in Massachusetts. The governor ultimately would like to see more than 4 million vaccinated, but they didn't pick a date. But just, reading the tea leaves here, I would think that, by May, June, everybody, and there'll still be stragglers. There'll be stragglers
right. Probably
all through the summer. But the vast majority, provided that vaccine supply keeps coming, by the summer, everybody should be vaccinated.
I feel like I should have a bubble over my head that just everywhere says, provided the vaccine supply keeps coming, like that's going to be the critical factor. Okay, so that was obviously the big focus of today's press conference, but the governor said some other things too. What else did you hear?
Yeah, don't let up on those other things that we've been doing. Mask wearing, hand washing, and of course, social distancing. Even as more people are getting vaccinated, he doesn't want anybody to let up on those things. He continued to talk about the importance of getting tested as vaccine rollout continues.
We think it's really important for people, if they have concerns, to continue to get tested. It's a big part of how everybody can continue to do their part to keep themselves their friends, their families, and their neighbors safe while we work through vaccination programs here and across the Commonwealth to put this virus behind us.
Now, another news item that the governor touched upon was a surprise increase in the number of doses being sent by the federal government.
We've said many times that we don't count it till it shows up in Tiberias. But the projections that the feds put out on the call yesterday were, especially with respect to J&J, which I've been talking about for a long time, were really encouraging, both for the very end of March and for the month of April.
Steve, that is really striking because just last week we heard sound from the governor sounding very angry about lack of supply and timeline, and he called out J&J then too.
Sure. Today he said that they got this surprise announcement that they're getting 8,000 single-dose J&J shots this week. Last week they were saying don't expect anything from J&J until April. Today is the middle of March.
So how quickly things change. Any idea? We are also in the middle of reopening. Any relationship there? Any idea how this timeline with the vaccines could impact our reopening?
Well, it seems more than the vaccine timeline. The state's going to be paying close attention to those other metrics that they've been following all along, infection and hospitalization rates. If those continue to trend downward, more reopening or easing of restrictions will take place. It's possible as more and more people get vaccinated, the infection and hospitalization rates will go down even further. So there's some cause and effect there. But they can't say anything right at this point, but it's heading in that direction. Things will be opening up as those infection rates continue to drop.
And did the governor get any questions for the questions about equity concerns, or did he address any further the equity concerns that have been raised over the vaccine rollout?
Yeah, the administration announced that the state will provide more financial support to municipalities and community health centers to connect with those hard-to-reach communities. Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutter said that the state received a $27.4 million grant from the CDC. Now, of that, $4.7 million is going to go directly to municipalities and local boards of health in 20 different communities. They can use that to set up more vaccine clinics. Another $4 million is going to go to outreach and education, and $10.6 million will fund direct services such as appointment registration assistance, transportation to vaccine clinics, mobility assistance, medical interpretation, or whatever is needed to be delivered by community-based organizations.
All right, for 30 seconds or so, Steve, I just want to talk politics. There has been a lot of criticism aimed at Governor Baker over the bumpy rollout in the last several weeks. How has it affected? He had stratospheric popularity early in this pandemic. Has that changed, and is he concerned?
He's not letting on that any of that criticism is bothering him. His job approval ratings have gone down without a doubt, but so have the approval ratings of many other governors around the country. His numbers were so high, so there's a lot of room for it to drop. So that poll released by Channel 5 and UMass yesterday showed that he would still beat a long list of potential Democratic challengers, but that election is still more than a year and a half away.
And with that is WBUR Senior Statehouse Reporter Steve Brown. Steve, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Tiziana.
We heard all about the big announcement today from Governor Charlie Baker. Patriots Day is the day, April 19th. That is when the general public can start getting vaccinations in the Commonwealth. It turns out phase four of reopening next Monday is also now the same day that essential workers and people age 60 and older can be vaccinated. Those are true signs, maybe, of a new normal. But still, new variants are continuing to pop up here in Massachusetts and overseas. There are some questions over the health impact of the European AstraZeneca vaccine, which is not available here in the United States, but is reverberating here. So with all this news, we thought you might have as many questions as we always do. So it's time. It is Ask the Doctors. Call with your coronavirus and vaccine questions at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now to help answer as many of those questions as we can is Dr. Christopher Gill, an infectious disease clinician and researcher who focuses on vaccines and the epidemiology of respiratory diseases at Boston University, also an associate professor at the BU School of Public Health. We also have Dr. Sabrina Asumu, an assistant professor of medicine at Brown University School of Medicine and an infectious disease specialist at Boston Medical Center. Dr. Gill, welcome back.
So great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Asumu, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Great to have you both. I'm just going to start with your reactions from both of you about the announcement from Governor Baker today with this timeline. Dr. Asumu.
Yeah, no, it's great news. It's always wonderful to see progress. You know, I see patients at Boston Medical Center, and I can tell you that despite a lot of the headlines, I have a lot of patients who are eager to get vaccinated. So having a timeline of when we'll be able to vaccinate more people, different people with different conditions, but also having a date that the general public could sort of use as to when they can be eligible for the vaccine. I think this is all great news.
Dr. Gill, I have to admit, it did make a difference even to me just to know when that might be. So kind of how big of a deal is it to have this clarity now today?
Oh, it's such wonderful news, don't you think? I mean, I think we have all felt for, you know, ever so long now, like how long do we have to wait before we can sort of feel that life is returning to normal? And I think having a specific date in mind where at least we know that, you know, now we can officially get into the queue is psychologically so helpful. This is sort of a strange metaphor to use, but, you know, there's this old story about the frog in the frying pan, and you heat the water up slowly and the frog doesn't know to jump out because the changes are so gradual. And I think what we're kind of looking at is this frog in the frying metaphor, but running backwards, where we've been in the hot water for all this time. Mm. And we're trying to sort of figure out, like, when will it just feel like a regular day again? And I think the metaphor is helpful because it's not like there's going to be a single point in time when suddenly we say we are here, right? I think it's going to be a much more gradual thing where every day is a little bit better. And actually that the pace of change improves every day. So every day not only gets better, but it's getting better faster. You know, the vaccine supplies are expanding, the logistic problems are being worked out, the politics behind this are being solved. All of these, you know, stepwise problems that are so essential in terms of like reaching that total goal of normalcy are being solved day after day after day. And the accumulated effect of those is that the pace of returning to normal, while it may not, we may never like wake up one day and say, here it is. We may wake up one day and say, my gosh, how did we get here? This feels normal again. Yeah. And I think that day is actually not so far off anymore.
I'm about to turn to the phones, but I do want to note for listeners, you can go to mass.gov and pre-register for the Commonwealth's mass vaccination sites there now, even if you're not eligible yet, and get in queue for when it's your turn to get a notification of potential appointment. So that's mass.gov. Dr. Asumu, I'm going to turn to the phones. We'll get a question for you. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Chris on the line in Rockland. Chris, what's your question?
Yes, hi. I'm 66 with underlying health conditions. I'm getting my second vaccine on Saturday. I know you have to wait a couple of weeks to be fully immunized after the second shot. I'd like to know, how is it safe, given my underlying health conditions, for me to go out to dinner in a restaurant, to go get my hair colored, which takes about 2 hours at a real hair salon? Can I go shopping? And then very quickly, second question is, I'm scheduled for a second shingles shot. How soon after the second Pfizer shot can I get the shingles shot?
Well, Chris, it sounds like you're looking forward to some new normalcy there. Let's go to you, Dr. Asumu, for answers to those questions.
So first of all, Chris, I want to congratulate you for getting online, for getting your first shot, and you're contributing to getting all of us back to the new normal. So first thing is, you know, first of all, you're aware that we like to wait for the 2 weeks because to be fully immunized, because that's when your body has had an opportunity to make all those antibodies that are going to protect you. But because, you know, the majority of people in Massachusetts and also the majority of people in the country, even though about 10% of people have been vaccinated, 90% have not yet been vaccinated and are not protected, it's going to take us still a while to get back to the new normal. So what does that mean? The good news is last week, you've probably heard the good news from the CDC and Dr. Walensky, who shared the recommendation from the CDC as to what we can and can't do. So the good news is, in terms of, you know, getting together with people within your household who are at low risk, if it is from one household, you can go see them. You can, you know, if they're low risk, you can take off your mask. So this is going to be gradual. And this is, you know, one of the things that we're recommending for people. In terms of other activities that you've listed, you know, going to restaurants, you know, I would love to be able to support our restaurants. I get takeout all the time, but indoor dining is still something that we would still recommend to limit and not do as much. Because, you know, there's still, you know, a lot of infections in the community and their variants. So until we all, a majority of people have been vaccinated, we're still recommending to limit certain activities. Another one that you've mentioned is getting your hair colored and other things. You know, we still sort of recommend that until the majority of people in the community have been vaccinated, that we still follow, you know, a lot of the public health measures that we've been recommending. I know it's probably tiring to hear, but there is some good news that there are certain things that we can do in households that are lower risk. We still recommend that even with other people who may be at higher risk, we can go outside and still connect. But for a lot of some of the other activities, such as traveling, even you've probably heard Dr. Walensky say that, you know, traveling, we still, you know, only recommend, you know, necessary travel and sort of watch that. And then getting back to your question about the single starts. First of all, I'm an infectious disease specialist, and I'm really excited to hear that you're getting all your vaccines. And so that's really great news. So usually, you know, the reason why, so we don't recommend taking two vaccines at the same time is because if you do have a reaction, it'll be hard for us to tell which vaccine, you know, may have created the reaction and for us to be able to make recommendations for you in the future. So the good thing is you're separating these vaccines, you're separating by them by a couple of weeks. And I think that should be enough and that should be fine for you. But I would, again, I don't know your personal history, so I would recommend that you specifically talk to your doctors. But as long as you're separating them by a couple of weeks, that should be fine. The other thing that I would also tell you is that the shingles vaccine also has been associated with some of the symptoms like fatigue and being tired, maybe having a little bit of fever that some people have also had with the COVID vaccine. But I must say that as an infectious disease specialist, I am very eager and excited to see that you're getting all your vaccines and protecting yourself and protecting the community.
All right, there you go, Chris. There's your answers. Dr. Gill, I'm going to put a couple questions together for you now. 1-800-423-8255. We're going to go to Louise in Westford first. Louise, go ahead.
Yes, hi there. I had my first Moderna shot about 2.5 weeks ago, and I tolerated it quite well. I just had, you know, what I expected, kind of the punch in the arm feeling. And after 24 hours, I felt kind of tired and achy. But then everything went away. And 2 weeks to the day, I got a allergic reaction. It was localized, nothing to worry about, but I had never heard of it. It was about the size of a silver dollar, red, itchy, raised, hot to the touch. It lasted for about 3 days. I did call my doctor, said it was nothing to worry about, and that some people get these more usually after 8 or 9 days rather than 2 weeks, but I thought that was a little bit strange. And I do have a rare condition called CVID that stands for common variable immune deficiency. And I was wondering if that could have anything to do with my reaction, and also if that could have anything to do with how well the vaccine will cover me.
Thanks for that, Louise. I'm going to add one other question, Dr. Gill. We've got Ryan on the line for Dorchester. Ryan, go ahead.
Hi, long-time listener, first-time caller. I would just want to know, after everybody gets all these shots, when is Biden going to turn on the microchips?
Oh, so microchip? Ryan, yeah, so every once in a while this happens, we'll have a caller who tells our producer that they're calling about one thing, and then when they get on the air, that's not really what they're calling about. So what I thought Ryan's other question, real question was, and I think this goes with Louise, Dr. Gill, is questions about percentage of people who do have allergic reactions, which may be one of the things Louise was asking about. So let's focus there. Her localized response 2 weeks later, and how often people do have allergic reactions to the vaccines?
Sure. So, Louise, those are excellent questions, all of them. And your question is particularly interesting in light of the CVID, which, for those who don't know, this is a condition where your body has difficulty making antibodies, and you know, therefore you're somewhat more vulnerable to infections caused by bacteria or viruses. So, you know, first to unpack the the adverse event that you experience, which sounds like urticaria. So it is entirely possible. I think we can't prove it one way or the other, but I think it's entirely possible that this reaction was triggered by the vaccination in some way. The good news, however, is that that urticaria is a very mild and common side effect. And as you experienced it, it came and it went after a couple of days. It might have been itchy and might have been, you know, something you don't want to look at, but it is not a dangerous thing. And it doesn't pretend the really serious thing that we're worried about, which is what we call anaphylactic shock, where like a bee sting allergy or peanut allergy, where people swell up and they can't breathe and they, you know, can actually become seriously ill. So this is not that. Whether this could be something that you experienced because of the CV idea, it's a really interesting theory. I don't know either way, but I wouldn't discount your theory. I think it's perfectly reasonable to ask that and wonder. But I think the more important thing is that this does not portend a more serious reaction for you when you have the second dose. So I hope that's reassuring. Now the second part of her question was whether CVID, her condition of CVID, might reduce the immune response to some degree. And the answer of that is probably yes, because this immune deficiency is characterized by a difficulty in producing antibodies. And so one would think that since vaccines mainly work through generating antibodies, that you're right, that, you know, your level of protection might not be as robust as someone else's who didn't have CVID. But how much relatively and how much does that matter is a very difficult question to answer, because what we've seen with both the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine is that the immune response to the second dose is really powerful. So, you know, if you see the rise of your antibodies from undetectable immediately after dose one to post dose one, you see a rise from zero to maybe, you know, a couple hundred ELISA units, which is how we measure the concentration of antibodies. But after dose two, you're way up in the thousands. So I would think that even if you have this condition, that the level of protection you're going to receive from the second dose is still well above what you would need to be protected. So I think I would not be terribly concerned about that, actually.
So now I'm going to turn to the two of you. And, you know, Ryan called and joking, I don't know if he was joking, asked about the microchip, right, which we know is one of the many theories of concern that people have around what could be in this vaccine and what is the government's intention. And we know that there is a range of vaccine hesitancy out there. One of the things that has been interesting is the latest data is showing that that's starting to draw along political lines there being a political bent to whether or not you want to get the vaccine. How do we address vaccine hesitancy as politics?
Tiziana, can I try to answer that one? Because I think that there are two issues at play here. The first one is what you mentioned, vaccine hesitancy. And I want to really emphasize that vaccine hesitancy is not necessarily logical. You know, these are brand new vaccines. You know, there's much that we don't know about them. And so it is reasonable and appropriate, I would say, actually, that some people would be like cautious, you know, with this, what is this new thing? What could happen? What could happen in 6 months? We don't know. The vaccines have only been around for 2 months. What could happen in 6 years? We won't know for 6 years. I mean, these are all legitimate questions. And I think people should think hard about the risk benefit. And I think it is clear that in the current environment where COVID-19 transmission is very high still, that the benefit, based on what we know about the safety, clearly outweighs the risks. But that is distinct from what I think we're seeing, like, you know, suggested by Ryan's comment about the, you know, when are the microchips coming, which sounds like, you know, a conspiracy theory,
which are not in the vaccines, right?
Which are not in the vaccines. You know, yesterday, for example, I had a question from a reporter who wanted to know about the fear of aluminum in vaccines. Now, this is really fascinating because aluminum has been studied ad nauseum, and it is, you know, the amounts that are found in pediatric vaccines, which is where aluminum salts are used as an adjuvant, are really trivial, right? You know, less than what is found in breast milk. And yet this is a trope that just rises again and again and again and again. And we're constantly having to play this game of whack-a-mole to sort of push back this mischaracterization. And it's particularly ironic in the current case because none of the COVID vaccines, including the AstraZeneca vaccine, which hasn't yet been licensed, include any aluminum at all. So it's totally irrelevant. And yet this is the you know, this is the argument that's put forward. And I think that's distinct from vaccine hesitancy, because these questions about aluminum or microchips, or the more conspiracy theory laden answers, are actually, I think, rather disingenuous, because they're not starting from any factual basis. There is no aluminum in any of these COVID vaccines, and so we don't even need to be talking about it. So why does this keep coming up? And of course, the, you know, people who are raising these things can do what I do, which is to go onto Google and look up the VRBPAC documents for each of these vaccines. I think you'd see perfectly well that there's no aluminum in them. It's not a mystery. And yet here we are.
I appreciate that, Dr. Gill. We have a bunch of questions. So Dr. Osumu, I'm going to match you up with another caller. We've got Jill on the line from Walpole. Jill, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm wondering, I have a 17-year-old son who is a grocery store worker. I have signed him up on the mass vaccination site. Am I safe to assume that if he gets called up to, say, go to Gillette, which is right down the street, that they will know he can only get the Pfizer because he is 17?
So that's
good
a
question.
Great question. So first of all, I am so encouraged to get all these questions from people who are either got one shot or ready to get vaccinated, because this is how we're all going to get to the new normal. So yes, the people at Gillette will know which vaccine to give him. Because the only vaccine that's been authorized for patients, you know, the one that's allowed between 16 and up is the Pfizer vaccine. The Moderna was only authorized for 18. So the people who are Gillette will know, because this is actually the only one that he could have. So I think you're in safe hands.
All right, let's grab another call here. We've got Joel on the line from Jamaica Plain. Joel, go ahead.
When the Pfizer vaccine came out, it was announced that it required ultra-cold storage in a unit that had temperature down to just a few degrees above absolute zeros. Units like this are not normally found in medical or pharmaceutical facilities, and yet these days the Pfizer vaccine is in very wide distribution. What's the answer to this apparent contradiction?
How'd we solve for
that?
Okay,
sure.
Dr. Gill.
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think we'll start by asking the question that precedes yours, which is, why is the Pfizer vaccine stored at this, you know, has it been stored at this ultra low temperature to begin with? And the answer is probably not a very satisfactory answer, which was the decision was made at the very beginning based on an abundance of caution. So we know that RNA is a very unstable molecule and needs to be kept ultra cold to stop it from basically degenerating over time. And so it is a prudent thing to do when thinking about a vaccine that is based on RNA. But as it turns out, Pfizer recently released new data showing that the storage conditions, the minus 80 centigrade, for example, turn out not to be actually all that important. And so they have issued new guidance that the storage can be under much more realistic, shall we say, conditions that could be attained, say, in a hospital, but probably not in a pediatrician's office or at a CVS, because they would still not have like a minus 20 freezer, which is still a fairly expensive and complicated bit of machinery. Now, the way this is actually executed, though, is that these vaccines are shipped in essentially high-tech freezer bags, if you will, packed on dry ice. And so the facilities that receive them don't need to have local capacity to keep it, you know, in a freezer at minus 20 or even, or certainly not at minus 80. They don't need to be able to do that, because they're packed to be used in a short period of time. And so the way this is working right now is that there's a sort of dance between supply and demand. And so the companies are trying to ship these packs so that the dry ice does not deplete by the time that they would be used. And so they're doling out the supplies as fast as they can be demonstrated to be usable at the sites. Like, so at Gillette, you know, they can maybe do 1,000, 2,000 people a day. And so Pfizer wants to balance its shipments to Gillette so that it you know, provides that same number of vaccines, so you don't have many left over at the end of each day after the dry ice starts to dissipate. So that's basically how it's happened. It's not assuming that these facilities would have a minus 80 freezer or even a minus 20 freezer. It is really an issue of trying to balance the use rate with the delivery rate, so that the cold temperature is maintained by the freezer bags and the dry ice, not by the local freezers.
All right, let's see if we can grab one more. We're on limited time, so we'll try to keep the question and the answer short. We've got David on the line in Natick. David, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm a supply driver by trade, and I'm a bit confused as to the timeline of when people in my business would be able to get the COVID vaccine.
Supply of what kind, David, just so we know?
Oh, just office supplies.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Asumu, do you know, is he March 22nd or later? Do you know?
Well, I think I'm trying to remember. So great. First of all, I am so encouraged to hear that so many people are interested in getting vaccinated. So in terms of the March 22nd, my understanding was that it included, first of all, people who are greater than 60 years of age, and also workers in certain sectors, such as food and agricultural, sanitation, public works, healthcare workers, and grocery. So it's a little bit unclear to me, so I am not really sure. So I will probably recommend that you connect with your supervisor to see what your job is classified under. And I wonder if maybe there's another way that you can get your vaccine earlier, like your age cutoff. Like if you were, the age cutoff is greater than 60 for March 22nd, April 5th, and then the age will be April 19th. The general public, but it's coming up pretty quickly. So even if you have to wait a little longer, it's not going to be that much longer.
Yeah, and I looked at mass.gov. I'm looking right now, and in that group of essential workers, it just doesn't say clearly either way on the website. So it would be good, I think, to check in with the supervisor. Okay, we have just a little bit of time left. We're not going to have time for more calls here. Callers, you know we will do this again. We do it every week, so if we didn't get to you today, we will in the future. In the last 30 seconds, really, Dr. Gill, let's just reiterate for everyone how confident they can feel that these vaccines are safe.
Yeah, so we have seen data now based on tens of millions of individuals, and particularly good data from Israel, where half the country has been vaccinated. And actually, the vaccines have proven, and I think even beyond my expectations, to be remarkably safe, and even better, remarkably effective. We've seen, in fact, that the administration of even a single dose seems to be highly effective. And that's been shown in Scotland as well as in Israel.
Wonderful. Dr. Christopher Gill, repeat doctor for us. Thank you so much. And Dr. Sabrina Asumu, a new doctor for us. Thanks to both of you. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Thank you for having me on.
So we want to remember now a local legend who died today. Dick Hoyt was 80. And for decades, he faithfully ran the 26.2-mile Boston Marathon, pushing his son, Rick. You see, Rick has cerebral palsy, and his father would push him along the course in a modified wheelchair that was specially designed by Tufts engineers. They started running the Boston Marathon in 1981, eventually launching Team Hoyt and the Hoyt Foundation, inspiring thousands of people around the country. There are now Team Hoyt chapters in Canada, Oklahoma, Arizona, San Diego, Virginia, just to name a few. By 2009, Dick and Rick had run more than 1,000 road races, but Boston was always Rick's favorite. They ran it together every year through 2013 when the bombing stopped what was supposed to be their last Boston finish. So they came back, and they finished as father and son in 2014, the year of Boston Strong. In 2016, Radio Boston's Tim Skoog spoke with Dick Hoyt. Here's Hoyt remembering the pair's first ever charity road race in Westfield, all the way back in the 1970s.
Well, at the time, I was 40 years old. I was not a runner, but we went down to the race. It was a 5-mile race. They gave us the number 00 to put on our chair. The gun went off, and we took off with all the other runners. Well, everybody thought we'd go to the corner and turn around and come back. Well, we didn't. We finished the whole 5 miles. When we got home that night, Rick wrote on his computer, "Dad, when I'm running, it feels like my disability disappears."
Boston Marathon legend Dick Hoyt there in 2016. He died today at 80. The road trip is a central part of the American identity. But for many, and specifically Black Americans, the road can be a place of repression, control, and lethal violence. And that is exactly the contradiction that Amani Willett explores in his new collection, A Parallel Road. Willett teaches photography at the Massachusetts College of Art and Design, and the Museum of Fine Arts has purchased 2 prints from this project. The full collection is also now out as a book. We caught up with Amani Willett recently, and he began by explaining this project, A Parallel Road.
My intention with this project was to really think about this idea that we have in our country of the road that holds this mythological status as a site of freedom, of exploration, of exuberance, and even quite literally the American dream. And I've always felt a little bit uncomfortable with that interpretation of the road, because my experience with the road and many of my friends and family's experience with the road has been quite different.
That was, Imani, for me, a real calling out in seeing that in this work. I grew up, I spent my childhood in Michigan, which, you know, has a love affair with the automobile, to say the least, as the home of, you know, Ford and all the other motor plants, et cetera. And this idea, you know, I grew up in the way back of that station wagon, and I grew up thinking that the road trip was this amazing American experience. And there wasn't a repudiation of that in going through the way you lay out both the joys and risks for Black America of traveling those same roads.
Yeah. So I mainly study photography and I'm a photographer. And even in the history of the medium of photography, you can see that the road trip itself is basically a whole genre of photographic practice. And some of our most iconic and known images come from this history of the, you know, experiencing America by road. But, you know, for me, what the road symbolizes is quite different. It, you know, it immediately brings up images of the civil rights movement as the road as a politically contested space where people have fought for generations for equal rights. And it also, you know, conjures images of a more violent and horrific underbelly and aspect of American society as a site of racial violence, fear, and oppression. So one of my main goals with this project was to bring this other experience into this more known symbol of this American iconic experience of the road trip.
So I want to talk about the art of this collection, the juxtaposition. You use archival material from the Green Book. It was a book that for nearly 30 years provided Black travelers with information on safe places to eat, places to stay while out on the road. You excerpt the 1940 edition. What most stuck out to you going back through the Green Book as you were putting all of this together?
Well, actually, yeah, it's a great question. And I came across this, the Green Book, about 10 years ago, sort of before it was in our cultural lexicon. It's really taken off, I'd say, in the last 5 years, where, you know, obviously the movie and also on scholarly research, it's been more of an artifact that's resurfaced and been unearthed. And, you know, it's really a damning document in a way, right? I mean, it lays bare the inequities, the potential violence, and the way systemic oppression had influenced the lives of Black Americans. And so just to even think about participating in this American experience that was purported to be available to everyone, they had to find innovative ways to navigate this highway system, this new highway system and roads that were, you know, actually at odds with their well-being. And so, sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's just, in listening to you, it's also striking me, but the tone of the pages, now you insert things that introduce a different tone into those pages, and we can come back to that. But the tone of the Green Book pages that you use aren't dark or foreboding. They are grand adventure and road trip.
Right. So this book was created by Victor Green, a postal worker, and he, you know, reached out to his network of other postal workers in America and created this book that would allow Black Americans to navigate the country in a way that offered them places to eat, restaurants, and quite frankly, a life of leisure. If you look at Jim Crow America, I mean, there really was this parallel economy that opened up because of segregation. So there was this thriving Black economy where there were Black-owned restaurants that were packed every night, clubs that were packed every night, listings for places you could get your hair done and your nails done and all sorts of things, right? But it was all in this parallel existence because in speaking to my family members and relatives about stories from growing up in the 40s, 50s, you had to really pack your car and think very systematically, but how are you going to get from point A to point B safely? So bringing pots and pans because you never knew if someone was going to allow you to use the restroom, packing food because you weren't sure where and if restaurants would allow you to eat. So this book really tried to give Black Americans a way to navigate that reality.
And then you insert, right? You insert in these pages. I missed it the first time. I went through the book the first time just looking through it. And then the second time, I cross-referenced every page with the citations that you have at the end of the book. And in doing that, I noticed the inserts that you had put into some of the Green Book pages. So on page 69, you subtly insert a quote, "Please don't tell me my boyfriend went," just like that. And that, of course, is Diamond Reynolds, the girlfriend of Philando Castile, who was fatally shot when pulled over in his automobile. What made you decide to present that information and that emotion in that way?
I think what I really wanted to do with this project was to create this emotionally resonant impressionist experience that showed the scars of trauma that systemic oppression and racism have been inflicting on the lives of Black Americans really from the beginning of our country's history. And the way I went about doing that was using this artifact, the Green Book, and then overlaying it with basically a history of the Black American experience on the road. I mean, obviously it's not completely comprehensive, but it's constructed from old family photos from family albums. It's constructed of images from the Library of Congress with images of Ku Klux Klan members. It has contemporary photographs of people who have been harassed and profiled while driving while Black, and also screenshots and images from social media and the way that violence against Black Americans has been mediated in the last 10 or 15 years. And so I think by creating this through line, which is the Green Book as the backdrop, and showing how this issue has really been going on for almost 100 years and unfortunately hasn't really changed. I mean, maybe the methodology of the intimidation and the violence has changed, but the systemic oppression has not changed.
I was struck earlier this year, we did a segment here on Radio Boston on the resurgence of the Black horror genre. And we talked about Lovecraft Country, which delves into the history of sundown towns. And you have multiple archival images of hand-painted signs warning Black people to leave town before the sun sets. Do you see this work not only as your own exploration, but as part of a larger body of expression and critical analysis that we're going through as a community and a society now?
Yeah, definitely. I would say so. And I'm glad you mentioned the sundown towns because not everyone knows about these, but these were towns, not just in the Southern America, but even here in Massachusetts, where Black people were not allowed to be after the sun went down, and they were, chased out or assaulted, if they were found to be there after dark. So there is this real legacy, and that something that we need to wrestle with as a society. To realize that this is, not just a problem of the South, but it was happening in our own backyard. This idea of the horror genre has been a really interesting way to create a metaphor for this issue of the fear and the violence that Black Americans have faced, that it is really this horror and this trauma. And I was thinking about that a bit when I made this project, and there is that side of it. And what has been really great for me is the way that people have responded to the book, and they've been able to relate to that sense of dread, that sense of unease that is created through the project, and for people to rethink their relationship to the road, right? To rethink their relationship to some of the privileges they've had as maybe white American or someone who's male, right? To navigate the country in a way that wasn't really possible for Black Americans, for women, frankly, in earlier years or even still now. So it's getting at those ways for people to emotionally understand the trauma, I think. And that's, I think, the similarity between maybe the horror genre and what I'm doing.
You know, thinking about the emotion and the trauma, you don't allow us in this work to ascribe these events to history. You very carefully bring forward current events. We talked about Philando Castile. You have Sandra Bland, a picture of her smiling on one of the pages. And then you have pictures from your own collection. You have your family. You have you. Did it cost you something to create work that doesn't shy away from the fact that we are still experiencing this violence, and then to situate some of yourself, your family, and your own art in that arc?
Well, I'll have to say, I mean, it was really powerful experience to, you know, interview family members, to hear about their troubles on the road, you know, how they have often thought twice about even getting in their car and driving at times, or a cousin who's was stopped by the police and separated from her young children and her children forced in the back of a separate police car and just not knowing what was going to happen to them because of the color of their skin. But to go through that archive that my family generously offered me, I had hundreds and hundreds of pictures of my family members with cars over the years. And to be able to use my family's experience to talk about what I feel is a really important larger issue. Because, you know, at the end of the day, this project is about the American road, but it's also a microcosm of what is happening just generally with race relations and systemic oppression in our country and our country's history. And so to be able to use my family's experience to talk about those issues felt quite, feel like I had a lot of responsibility, but it was also quite profound and something that I found to be really, I guess in a way I'm proud that I could use my family's experience, you know, I feel to and connect them to this history and to hopefully use their experience to bring to light some of the injustices.
That was artist Imani Willett. He teaches photography at the Massachusetts College of Art and Design, and his new collection is called A Parallel Road, which is out now as a book. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderek, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer, Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.